If my 18-year-old self met my 30-year-old self, he'd be like, what the hell? Where are your, where are your Tony Awards? Where did you go wrong? Right
now? Hey, everyone. This is Kira Lee.
And this is Daniel.
And this is the Actor Hack Podcast.
We're coming from Brooklyn, New York, and we have Ben with us today.
Hey, Ben.
Hi, Kira Lee. Hi, Daniel.
So, Ben, tell us where you're from.
I'm from New Jersey. Haddonfield is a town like 10 minutes from Philadelphia. So I did my undergrad at Syracuse, and I got a BFA in musical theater.
When you graduated, did you pursue acting at all?
No, actually, I didn't. My junior year of college, I kind of had this come-to-the-light moment for myself where I was really just seeing a lot of what people were experiencing when they were graduating and all that. And there were just, I think, some very clear realities of working as an actor in the business that I think is just a lifestyle question, and it wasn't something that I was really prepared to do. I could never have seen myself just not working in theater at all, and so I was like, well, if it's not that, then what's the next progression of that? For me, that was casting, actually, and so I started like doing casting internships, which led me to work as in a talent agency, two different ones for a couple of years there, and then that was just TV, theater, and film, and I was really much more about just, like, one-third of that pie.
So when you were saying that you, like, were sort of waking up to the realities of being an actor, like, yeah. Were you talking to alum, or were you talking to...
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we had plenty of alumni who were in the world of Syracuse, so mm-hmm. It was definitely a lot of talking to people like that. Our program finished off with a semester that put you in New York, and also gave you lots of master classes with theater professionals, casting directors. It is great. But even by then, I was kind of like a little bit more, I kind of knew that if I was going to pursue a life in the theater, it was probably going to be on the other end of the footlights. It wasn't an easy decision, and it didn't come without questioning, for sure.
Right.
I don't feel like I made the wrong choice necessarily for myself.
So when you decided, okay, I want to go back to school, where did you start?
I had, like, a really bizarre kind of experience going back to school, or, like, getting accepted to go back to school. So I knew that there was, like, this handful of criteria that I wanted from a program, and I wasn't quite sure, like, what that meant. In this moment, when I was working in agencies, and I was like, well, you're doing TV and theater and film, you care most about the theater stuff, how can we make it so that you're only doing theater stuff all the time? I, like, had to really, like, think about what that meant. Does that mean working with actors? Does that mean working with other kinds of theater artists? And I was like, well, what is it that you love about theater that keeps you coming back to it? In one way or another, it would always come back to the storytelling component of it. Then I was like, oh, well, then I'm probably interested in, like, writers and composers and lyricists and things like that. And then I kind of also had this panic moment where I was like, well, if I want to be versed in playwrights, I feel like I've spent so much of my life so far worrying about acting and worrying about actors and all that stuff. It's like, well, what if I don't know enough about playwrights and about composers and lyricists? And I wasn't like a slouch or anything like in those topics, but I definitely felt that there were other people out there who knew more about it than I did. And so I really wanted to go for a program that was going to give me like a really rich background in theater history and really just dive into the deep end and just like spend years like just like reading scripts and like breaking them down and figuring out like what works about these things. And dramaturgy is a word that I was not super familiar with. I mean, it was a word I've heard, obviously, but it wasn't something that I was like in my vocabulary using
right.
all the time.
I totally understand what
yeah.
that means.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, that's a thing. Brooklyn College has this theater history and criticism program, and I always liked writing, and I always liked the idea, and the idea of, like, criticism sounded interesting. And so then when I was looking through all these different programs and everything, I kind of reached out to the people at Brooklyn College. It seemed like a dramaturgy light program without kind of knowing what that meant, but it wasn't like so much as going for the rigor of going for a dramaturgy degree, but it also kind of gave you this lit crit in depth text analysis and really figuring out like what criticism means versus like reviewing and all these things. And I just reached out to a professor and was like, hey, can you maybe tell me more about the program? And she was like, yeah, tell me more about yourself. And so then we kind of had this dialogue going, and she was like, yeah, you should definitely apply to this. And she actually like helped me through the application process. And like then like once I submitted, she was like, congrats, you're in. It was bizarre because it felt like very informal. And oh, I guess I'm going to grad school then.
Did you just like get her information off the website?
Yeah, like I started like, I mean, she wasn't the only one I was looking at, but they were definitely like really communicative, and it definitely was the one that I felt was the best fit for me. I really didn't want to leave the city either, because there was just so much anxiety I had about, like, you leave New York, what happens? You fall off the face of the earth. Right. And, which is not true. Right. It's not true. It's not true. Yeah, so I was definitely looking for something based in the city, something that was going to be small. And since I wasn't sure what it was, what I was pursuing, what I really had in mind for myself, it was definitely a great program for me because I was really able to shape it the way that I wanted it to be. It's a great degree because if you want to go for, like, the PhD route, it kind of, like, fast-tracks you. But I was like, well, I want to be more of a theater practitioner and work, like, in the business. And then I had just some really great professors the whole way through who were like, well, if you're interested in playwrights and you want to work in, like, artistic or literary things in the theater world, then you should be working at... You should intern the whole time at theaters that really have a very strong focus on those kinds of things. So I just spent my whole 2 years in grad school just, like, living at New Dramatist and Signature Theater. And Signature has, like, the whole mission is, like, the devotion to the playwright, and New Dramatist is a service organization that gives playwrights resources over a 7-year residency and many other wonderful things. There, and those are, like, two places, like, with the playwright and the art, like, that kind of artistry at the center of the mission. And their hearts are just, like, so in the right place. So it was a great place to kind of get more hands-on experience, like, in while in an educational setting.
How did you get those internships?
Teachers of mine, she was listening to me. I mean, she was really hearing what it was that I was interested in doing. They were just really advocating for me to go, like, well, if that's your mission, then you got to find these theaters that are really putting the playwright at the core of their mission. Right. So many theaters, of course, have the playwright at the core of their mission, but, you know, some people actually, like, put that in writing. And New Dramatist is also just, they're more of a service organization for writers. So it was kind of like getting this double side of experience.
And were you interning there while you were in school?
Yeah, I was interning there, like, the whole time. Both organizations are, like, really wonderful, caring organizations. And I did a couple rounds as an artistic intern at Signature. And I also, like, worked in their box office to make some pennies while, like,
yeah, I was going to ask how you were, like, supporting yourself.
That's a tricky thing always, right? They tell you things like, it's a part-time degree. And you're like, great, what does that mean? And it means you're in class part of the time, but you have, like, full-time homework.
Yeah.
And if you want to actually, like, do the work that you're taking out the loans to go to school to do, theoretically, you want to, like, make sure you're actually committing to your homework and doing the readings and doing all this stuff. It was definitely a different kind of approach than undergrad, from what I remember. I definitely needed to stop working full-time job. I did take out some loans to, like, have a little bit more support for paying groceries and paying rent and stuff like that.
How long is that program?
That's a 2-year program. Okay. And it's an MA, which is also something that I didn't understand the distinguishing factors between, like, an MA, an MFA, and a PhD and all that stuff. There are shades of master's degrees out there, right? And so an MA is a master's of arts, an MFA is a master of fine arts. MFA is a terminal degree, which means, like, you've learned all there is to learn about the subject. And you basically need that to kind of, I think, like, walk into a university setting and say, like, I have the qualifications to be hired.
Right.
If you have a master's degree that isn't a terminal master's degree, you can still teach at an academic level. It's just that you need to supplement it with professional experience. Now I'm teaching a little bit on the side at a university level, but I've been working in, like, literary management for over 3 years.
And so then when you graduated, did you immediately have this job?
My timeline has always been really, really lucky. I did, actually. So certainly once I hit my second semester of my final year of school, I was really trying to pound the pavement and make connections with people and go on all the job search sites all day long, and you have a million different kinds of resumes ready to go. Certain things are front-loaded on other cover letters or stuff like that, and you're just, like, busy, like, preparing all that. Use connections that I knew I had, like, also, like, meeting with professors to see if they had any career tips, any kind of professional advice, people they could put me in contact with, and did that with all the people at my internships, too. And sometimes those things would pan out, and sometimes they wouldn't, but you never know what conversations actually would take off. And so it's always just, I think, about casting a wide net.
I don't think it's luck. I think that you worked your ass off.
Right. Yeah, barely.
I mean, it just happened after all of this work that I did.
Maybe it's not luck, but I definitely feel like I've been lucky in, like, having pretty much consistent employment. I was talking to a lot of people interviewing, and then a lot of interviews just, like, kind of, like, came up around the same time, and I didn't get plenty of them. So I ended up applying at this company, Samuel French, which is play publishing and theatrical licensing company that, you know, if we ever, if any one of us did in our town in high school, you've, like, held the script.
Right. Absolutely.
You know that cover.
Yeah, exactly. It's a pretty iconic thing if you've, like, done theater growing up, especially. There was a job for a literary associate. I always feel like you need to make calls to people, or maybe not calls, texts or emails or whatever, but find out, like, who in your network knows who in somebody else's network so that you can get your foot in the door. It's not that they're getting you the job, like, you're getting the job, but in a profession where there's so much competition and not enough jobs really available, it only helps you, of course, to have somebody who can, you know, speak to your behalf, someone who can help you, like, your resume rise to the top of the pile. So, like, whenever I was looking for a job, I would always be like, all right, if I'm looking at this organization, who do I know who knows someone in that organization, or do I have someone in that organization who I can, like, reach out to and be like, hey, just want to let you know, I sent in my application. If you think that I'm appropriate for the position, I'd love to come in and talk about it. Very low-stakes sort of things like that. Eventually, somebody, like, can help you probably get your foot in the door and just get you that very first phone interview, which is what happened with my job at Sam French.
What does a literary associate do?
Interesting question. So I've been there for over 3 years now, so I'm literary supervisor now, and was brought on as the associate. And I think if you think of, like, a literary associate or anyone in, like, literary management, that's probably an easier term to use. But in, like, literary management in a theater company, what are you doing? You're probably practicing, like, production dramaturgy on a show, hopefully, if it's an older piece, then maybe you're doing more research about, like, actual time periods and stuff like that. If it's a new work, you're probably working with the writer or the composers to shape material, shape script, clarify character intentions, things like that, and really just make the piece work. And also there's this whole aspect of, like, the season planning, I think, that also comes in with a theater company. And script scouting and playwright scouting and figuring out who the new artists are that you want to work with, trying to sort of develop them in one way or another, whether it's through, you know, commissioning them in the theater company, I suppose. And this latter half of that is really kind of how the literary management stuff sort of plays out more at Sam French. In my job in the literary field over there, we're not making plays happen. We're not a theater company. We're not producing work. So we're not doing the dramaturgical side of things. What we are doing is a lot more close to something like a season planning, in a way. It's totally not season planning at all, but we curate the catalog of plays and musicals that we have. Similar to when artistic and the literary directors at theaters across the country are, you know, doing season planning and considering a wide range of plays and cherry-picking what it is they want to do for their next season, we have the wonderful job. It really is a wonderful job, but it's a big job. Of looking at an even broader spectrum, I think, because we're looking at the whole of American theater, for the most part, or at least the whole of American theater that is opening in this season, and figuring out what it is that we want to publish. A lot of that is driven by New York, because for better or worse, I think it's kind of undeniable to say that New York really does dominate the theatrical conversation in the country.
It's dictating what regional theaters are going to be doing.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And and I'm not saying that's not without its flaws, or maybe we couldn't have a broader picture of what American National Theater means as opposed to just, like, what New York theater means. Mm-hmm. Regional theaters want to do the play that's been on Broadway and stuff like that. I'm not saying it's not problematic, but there is definitely something about New York City that is like, this is the finish line for a play or a musical, right?
Right.
So it's like you had a big off-Broadway production or you have a Broadway production. It's like, it's done. You did the thing. Congratulations. On one hand, we look towards a lot of things like that because when we are looking for work to pick up, so much of it has to do with its exposure and how much, and are people going to discover it? Because no one ever comes to a licensor to license a world premiere, really. The shows that people that we pick up, you know, have to be vetted. They have to be, quote-unquote, audience-tested. You want them to have reviews, hopefully good reviews, because that makes it easier for our marketing team to then speak about it to the world. You know, then it's a lot about the strategic rollout of those things. If you have a play that's, you know, been on Broadway, clearly the next big goal is going to be to make sure that play hits all the major cities around the country at the most illustrious theater that they have there. You want to make sure that the playwright is getting the best showing. And so that's not even what I'm doing. That's all licensing. For us, it's about identifying writers, scouting them out, constantly being on the lookout for new talent, and trying to, as best we can, which is a constant job, to have our finger on the pulse of American theater, so that we're not just looking in New York.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you travel and things.
We do travel. We do travel. It's tricky to... You can't catch everything even through traveling, so it's reading, really. And I'm not alone there, either. I'm part of a three-person team. And we are always reading plays, and we are always seeing plays and musicals every day on the subway back and forth from my home to my workplace. It's always scripts on the iPad. I think on average, probably throughout the year, we probably end up seeing stuff for the company about three nights a week. And it's time-consuming, and it's definitely like a lifestyle job. And I think that is... Any position, I think, that comes with some sort of artist scouting or something like that, artistic development, it's just going to require you to be out at the theater a lot, because you have to know what's out there, and you can't just read reviews and... What does Mama Rose say in Gypsy's, like, reading book reviews like they were books? You can't do that. You gotta actually, like, see the show, be able to talk to the, speak about the work. And it's impossible because, like, you just can't see everything. And I've gotten pretty far to giving up almost every single night of my years before to seeing shows, and it's...
You're reading scripts in order to consider them to be published?
Yeah, so if literary management has a broad-ish definition, all literary managers are always reading scripts, probably seeing all the plays they can in their community, or trying to, you know, look for writers and look for people to identify as, you know, emerging talents or people they want to cultivate or someone you just kind of want to track and follow and see how they do. So it's always script reading, and we're always reading them with the eyes on publication. Publication is, like, always, like, the end goal. It's publication and licensing is what we do. Whenever we're looking at something, it's, like, are we interested in doing that? Things are at different places in the lives of the work. Sometimes, if a writer is just someone who I've heard of or someone who I have, like, a beginning relationship with or something, they have a new piece and they're like, well, would you just be interested in reading it, like, for the future? It's like, of course, I'd totally be interested in reading it. I might not read it tomorrow, I might read it right. In the next 3 months, but we have a huge pile of scripts all the time. You can't get to them all immediately. The best case scenario, I think, is you get a script early on, or you go to, like, the first or second reading of a show, you make a connection with the writer, stay in their mind. You sort of try and make sure you're staying in their mind, so it's maybe you got a copy of the script first, then you find out that they have a reading coming up. You're like, great, I will be at that reading. I'm looking forward to it because I like the script and I'm really interested to see how it works when actors speak it out loud. Hopefully that reading eventually turns into a production. Maybe it's a rolling world premiere or something, or maybe it's just like doing an out-of-town sort of thing before it comes to New York. You want to keep on that. Maybe like write them an email after a review comes out, see how it did, and just sort of touch base. So then hopefully by the time when it comes to New York or it plays off Broadway or whatever it is, you've been in their mind from the beginning. It's the best case, and it makes you feel really good about the work you do, I think. When we've been able to publish a play, especially when it's a writer who's at the beginning of their career, I mean, it's an honor to be able to publish and work with people like Sarah Rule and Will Eno. Like, do not get it twisted. It is, like, really exciting, and people like that are awe-inspiring. But it's a different set of warm fuzzies, I think, you get when you see maybe someone who's more of a spring chicken, and then you're like, oh, I think this is really special. Like, maybe this person is a diamond someone hasn't found yet, and maybe we can be the ones to, like, sort of push them up and, you know, make them at least more discoverable to the regional theaters after something in New York has happened.
Oh, that's going to be really rewarding.
Yeah, right? There have been a couple times when writers have come up to me and like a cast party or something later down the road, been like, Ben was at the first reading for this show, and like he likes the nicest things to me, and he's been with it since the day one. And that's really, I don't know, where you feel the high of why you wanted to work in the industry and why you make all the sacrifices you do to work in the industry, why you take the financial hits, and why you give up so much of your personal time to see the good and the bad shows and everything in between. Because when it actually does pan out, it's meaningful. Personally speaking, I don't take like a name like a Samuel French lightly. You get these scripts in your hands when you're 16 sometimes. Our company is over 150 years old. Very historic. There's something just of legacy. It's the permanence of publishing. It's like you're putting something into a book, cementing one way or another, like artistic work's place in history. And we're not the only ones who do that, of course. And so it's not like if Samuel French doesn't publish the show, then, you know, it's gone forever. Like, that's not true, obviously. People like us can, in some ways, be, like, the... I don't want to say the gatekeepers. The preservation, like, help preserve the legacy of the American theater. Mm-hmm. Gatekeeper sounds so exclusive. Like, we're, like, keeping people out. And that's really not what I mean. Right?
No,
but what I mean is,
mean.
Like, there is something about historical preservation that's happening with these sorts of plays. And right. that I hope that we are... identifying really significant, amazing voices who are going to be the people who get taught in the future. It's wonderful to be able to help these people out and really help them realize their artistic ambitions. We're also maintaining the legacy of American theater in one way.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I
My
remember...
My 18-year-old self would think that's really cool.
No, I just remember being, like, Lake Charles, Louisiana, community theater, and we would get our, like, yeah. Samuel French script, like, for the play.
Totally.
And, like, plays are gone. Like, when they're done, right?
Yeah. So
there's maybe a video record of it, maybe, but the true what's gonna last is the printed version of it.
Yeah. And again, I work at Samuel French. We are, the, like, when... Whether it's people like us or... DPS or PlayScripts or MTI or RNH or TRW and Tams Whitmark. These are all people helping to hold up that legacy in one way or another. Something I mentioned earlier is also how we need a play to be able to be found. People don't come to a licensed world premiere, and that's tricky because it kind of puts writers in, like, sort of between a rock and a hard place. Mm-hmm. Well, I need someone to talk about this play so that people can find this play. But people aren't going to know to find this play if we don't have productions, and
yeah.
like, how do you get the productions if you need the word of mouth, and how do you spread the word of mouth if you don't have the productions? There are other things out there now which are fantastic, like new play exchange and script sharing networks like that, that actually help, I think, writers, you know, put stuff online that then can be discovered. They can kind of do their own marketing for it, mm-hmm. help probably drum up their own productions at regional community theaters and things like that, so that they can get more of test the work out more before, you know, they come into a place like New York, or they try to approach, you know, a more conventional publisher. And so I think that's also really a nice way to sort of popularize that sort of industry.
That's cool. I didn't know that existed. What's it called again?
New Play Exchange is one of them. It's like a script sharing network. You or your writer, you put your play up on there. You get your royalties and everything in the way that you would if you were with us. But, you know, it's all on you. And then, you know, you're the one who they're talking to. And, and you have to, like, deal with all the stuff yourself. That's why you often hand it over to a publisher.
Yeah.
Because,
right.
you know, you want someone else to take care of your licensing, to take care of it, and make sure that... And there's a savvy also with it. It's like, you probably don't know what are the... better theaters in Idaho.
Right?
It's
right.
like, I don't know what those theaters are. Uh-huh. However, our licensing representatives who, like, work with theaters in Idaho know all about that and can, like, help you figure that out.
Is there another step to your career? Is there...
So what is it? What are my other theatrical dreams and goals and everything? I love reading scripts and really, you know, that artist scouting aspect of literary management is something that I think is really exciting and great. And I think that cuts across the board to many kinds of literary management. Something that we don't do, like I said, is, you know, actual, like, productions. And so I'd love to work more, actually, in the rehearsal room and actually, like, within a theater company.
Dramaturgy level?
I mean, I'd love to do it, like, in the literary management level, where it's, like, you dramaturg, you work with, hopefully, with, like, newer shows and musicals, where you can help to, like, shape the work and work to give feedback, help the piece become fully realized, is definitely something that I would... really, really be interested in. It's something I always think about in theater, and something that is probably good for everyone. I have a job in a subset of theater that I want to work in, right? But I know that if the literary management pie is, you know, as if we're looking at, like, a pie graph, I'm getting a large chunk of that pie through this job. However, I know that I'm not doing, like, the dramaturgy experience. And so it's like, well, how do you then... make in a field where it is very competitive and where there are lots of people out there who are wonderful and super qualified and deserve these jobs, how do you make yourself stand out? How do you make yourself relevant? Part of my solution to that, or if you want a certain kind of job, it's like, what do you have right now that makes you right for those job postings? When people say, like, person applying for this job has to have X, Y, and Z, and, you know, you have X and Y through your, like, 9-to-5 job, and my personal experience, I've been the type of person who, on my off hours, it's like, well, that's where I need to go to make up for the Z that I'm missing on my 9-to-5 actual resume.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it's like, then I need to probably, like, dramaturg stuff outside, or I need to produce things outside or need to be doing more critical writing outside.
That's such a good way to think about it.
And I think the longer you do it also, the more likely it is to wear on you, because it takes up a lot of your time for no other reason than it just takes up your time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you want to stay competitive, you have to take on supplemental projects. And hopefully those supplemental projects sometimes will give you money, but a lot of the times they might not. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes there are other benefits to it, right? So it's like maybe you aren't getting compensated in a traditional way. Maybe you're getting paid with, like, muffins or donuts or something.
No, right.
But, which we've all done, it gives you something new on your resume, or you get to work with a certain kind of person or an artist who you've always been really excited to work with. You make those sort of choices along the way, and that's kind of just like, all right, well, you gotta figure that out for yourself and figure out, like, what you're willing to do. If your job is only giving you, like, 90% of what it is that you want out of your next job, then it's like you need to figure out how to supplement that in a way that you can put it on a resume and not just be like, well, trust me, I'll be really great when you hire me to do those things.
Right.
It's like, no one's going to say yes to that. Not when there are plenty of people out there who do it all the time.
Yeah. The position that you're in right now, mm-hmm. do the other people that you work with, do they also have masters?
No, actually. I'm actually the only one on the team with a master's degree. They all have backgrounds in dramaturgy, in literary management in theaters. They've all, like, a lot of them, they've both worked at theater companies. Both of them have actually worked regionally more their whole lives than I have, actually. I've been the one who's probably been in New York the longest. So it's nice to have this sort of diversity of opinions, because we're all from different regions of the country, too.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So we've all seen different kinds of subsets of theater across the country. One of us is from, like, the Pacific Northwest. Another one of us is from the Southwest. I'm from the East Coast, mm-hmm. and all that. And so I don't know. It's
pretty easy to lose perspective when you're in New York.
Oh, it's so easy. Right? I mean, like, I spent my life growing up in New Jersey and New York. So yeah. I think that everyone's probably going to do very liberal, progressive theater.
Right.
And that's just really, and that's not the case. I mean, especially if you look at a lot of the theater throughout the country that gets produced, and we have those numbers at Sam French.
Right.
It's like, we know like what people are doing regionally, and we know what shows are getting licensed more than other shows, at least the shows that we have. And it's telling. It's definitely like information to know like what kinds of work theaters are looking
for.
It's
so interesting.
It is really interesting. Or just, you know, like say like where is community theater in relationship to professional theater, and how does that, are they hip to doing the stuff that, you know, is coming from off-Broadway that is really, like, maybe pushing the envelope more? Maybe not. Maybe it takes them a year or two to get there. That's just the interesting thing about being in a city where it's like you feel like there is so much, for lack of a better word, control over the conversation. Mm-hmm. Where it's like, we think that the theater world is this one thing and wants this one thing, but we're really just this one town out of a huge country where a lot of people aren't always ready for that thing or just have different prerogatives.
You're reading a lot of new work, right? But
All new work. Yeah, I mean, we should read stuff from our back catalog, just so we know we have, but
say a playwright has been working for a little while and they're just sort of flown under the radar for a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
They find something, so then you have to go back and, like, read all of their work, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's what I see what you're saying. Yes.
I mean, it's right.
I mean, like, new work to me.
It's not new assignment or something, but...
But that's, I mean, we definitely, there have been numerous times, even, like, in the past couple months, that where it's, like, we've picked up plays that received, like, their world premiere in, like, the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not that these plays haven't been kicking around. It's that maybe, you know, they have been kicking around, and for whatever reason, now is the more opportune moment to pick them up.
Right.
Or they're having a bit of another moment again. And so then it's like, oh, well, let's look at this writer again or something. It's not the most common scenario, but it's not unfamiliar.
Mm-hmm. So, like, are there trends where you're, like, reading, like... You're like, I'm reading a Latina plays from the 90s this month, you know?
That's
right?
Like, really funny that you say that, actually, because that's, we just picked up some Octavio Solis plays from the 90s, actually, that are wonderful.
Right.
So there was a moment when, I think actually our associate was doing that, Garrett, who's our literary person from the Southwest, from Texas. That's like a really interesting thing. It's like when you start to see these trends happen, and when you're seeing and reading theater en masse like that, it's easier to sort of see more of the forest for the trees. And so you can I don't know, pick up on these things. Like, I remember there was, in, like, the 2014-15 season, I remember there was 1 month when I had seen, like, 3 plays about immigration issues. And it was like, oh, well, okay, so the theater world is interested in having this conversation right now. Mm-hmm. Last year, there was another set of 3 plays where, playing with naturalism, John, Andy Baker's John, mm-hmm. Stephen Karam's The Humans, and Anne Washburn's Aunt Pneumatica, I thought, at least, this is an example of, like, there are these 3 plays that are happening in this one theatrical season. They're all going so hard for, like, naturalism slash realism, and then it hits the point where, whatever, like, something happens in the play, and it's like, this naturalism kind of gives way to something that's, like, supernatural, or something that is metaphysical. You see that in one play, and you're like, oh, wow, that's so interesting. And then you see it in 3 plays, and you're like, wait a minute. Is this a blip? Is this a coincidence? Or is this just a minor trend right now? Or is it something that's really going to take wing and become something that gets taught about in schools? Like, you know, we're talking about surrealism right now, or we're talking about naturalism, where it's like, is it a movement? Is it a moment? I don't know. I think
These artistic directors having this conversation.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't know. And that's the thing. That's the interesting thing about being in it. I don't have the answer to that. I can posit many things, but...
Oh, that's so interesting.
We're not going to know for, like, 15 years.
Right, we'll see. I guess. Since you read a lot of plays, do you have a trick or, like, a tip to about, like, how... Like, what
you can, like, read a lot of plays.
Yeah.
Oh, no. And honestly, I'm, like, I'm not a fast reader. There are people who I work with who are such fast readers, mm-hmm. and I always say, it's like, if I had a superpower that I could have, it wouldn't be flying or anything like that. It would probably be speed reading. Not even just, like, for scripts and for functionality, but just to read Harry Potter in 5 minutes.
Right.
I have more tricks to reading books than to reading plays, because I feel like when I'm reading something that isn't, you know, someone's livelihood doesn't necessarily depend on it,
right.
I'm much less precious about reading the, like, said Hermione's, you know, like, and I can, like, gloss over, like, the things between the chunks of text between dialogue sometimes, or skim through that and get through a chapter faster. Mm-hmm. But in a play, I need to, like, read all that. I can't miss words. It's important to read the stage directions. Like, in high school, I remember I'd be reading plays and I would just read the dialogue, and I would not always read the stage directions because you don't need to pay attention to those words in italics. It's probably just blocking. And that's not the truth. It's not the case. Especially in contemporary playwriting, there's so much to be learned about plays through the stage directions. Mm-hmm. And that's, like, where you'll often see playwrights really let their voice shine through, or really what their artistic vision for the show is in the stage directions. All the more imperative that we read them. totally. Exactly. Sarah is, like, the classic example of someone like that. I don't have tricks to make it go faster other than just doing it as often as you can so that you kind of get in more of a groove. Mm-hmm. But even when you are in a groove, it's like, I only get in a groove because I read a similar kind of thing again and again and again. Mm-hmm. Some things I think that are helpful that I would say to writers, and I would never tell a writer how to actually write their play, but in terms of the formatting, what helps me get through something quicker is I hate having to go back to the front of the play to reference it while I'm reading the play. Mm-hmm. I like it to be, like, characters to be introduced to me as the story is unfolding. Say I'm reading, like, Angels in America. You have a stage direction that says, when, like, Belize makes his first entrance, that says, like, enter Belize, mid-30s, African-American, male nurse, former drag queen, wonderfully flamboyant, like, whatever descriptions you want to put in to, like, mm-hmm. make it's like giving it the entrance rather than just, like, enter Belize, and I would be like, who the fuck is Belize?
Right.
And then, like, go back to the front of the script, and then, like, what? And then go back to where I am in the play.
Right.
Playwrights,
especially,
like,
that play. Jesus, there's
so much. It's a lot to keep track of. But
yeah. Who that is. Yeah.
So I always like it when playwrights can kind of keep momentum of the story going throughout as the play is going on, rather than having to have, like, references to the beginning and having to, like, chop it up, because that just makes me get through it a little bit quicker and it just keeps me in it. My hack would be when we're, like, looking for work and when we are looking for the next project or whatever the next step is, it's so easy, I think, to just kind of get into your head and get scared that, like, it's not going to work out and that you're never, you know, you're going to, like, die in the gutter in the next month or something like that, mm-hmm. which is obviously melodramatic. There are just so many times when I feel like you don't see how your experience adds up, and I think that so many times, I cannot tell you the number of times in my personal career and experience, the most random connection has panned out in the most unexpected way. And it's like, oh, I never thought that this person who I, like, met 2 years ago at this one thing was actually going to be, like, the instrumental thing that, like, mm-hmm. helped me get this next rung on the ladder in my career. It's always, like, you don't know where those connections are going to pan out. And as long as you are, I think, you know, working well with people, being kind, thinking of the work, and I think, you know, really being authentically who you are and, like, what it is that you want to do, things fall into place in really unexpected ways, and I just trying to have faith in your resume, trying to have faith in the professional and personal connections you make throughout your time in your career are not to be underestimated.
Well, I'm going to ask you to do one random thing, because it's literally one of my favorite New York stories.
Oh, yeah. So, okay. I love Halloween. Many years ago, I was working in Midtown. I was working at a talent agency. Some of us would come to work dressed in our Halloween costumes. And so I was going to work dressed as Kenneth the Page from 30 Rock. And since this is a podcast, you can't see that I am not physically dissimilar from Kenneth. And I was also, like, the office manager slash, like, answer the phones at this first job, too. So it was also appropriate in that way. So I got off the train on 43rd and 8th off the A, walking down toward 9th Avenue on 43rd Street, and there's all these trailers lined up there, and they're obviously shooting something. There is this guy who's on headset, like a PA or something, and he has a headset, and he has a clipboard, and he comes up to me, and he's like, excuse me, sir, are you the stand-in? And I'm like, what? What are you... I don't know what that means. And he's like, are you the Kenneth? Are you the stand-in for Jack? And I was like, one more time. And he's, like, looking me up and down in my costume and, like, indicating everything that I have on. He's like, are you the Jack McBrayer, Kenneth, stand-in? This is 30 Rock. And I was like, what? No. This is my Halloween costume. And he was like, wait a minute. And I was like, yeah, like, I'm going to work. Just, like, we, like, dress up in our office, and I'm going to work dressed as Kenneth the Page because I like the show. And he was like, we are literally filming an episode of 30 Rock right here, right now. It's Jack McBrayer's scene. He's going to be here at noon. I was like, you have to come back. And I was like, okay, I'll come back. And so I ran to work. I told my bosses, they all, like, flipped out. They're like, this is the craziest thing! And so I ended up, like, on my lunch break, I went to this place, I met these people again on 43rd and 8th. The same PA recognized me and was like, oh, you're here, okay, great. And so he brought me to the trailer, he knocks on the door, Jack McBrayer pops his head out, and the PA is like, that guy I was telling you about is here. And he comes out, and he, like, sees me in my Page uniform, and he's like, oh my god, nobody's ever dressed up like me before. And I was, like, kind of flabbergasted, and, like, John Moore, like, oh my god, hi, it's so nice to meet you, I'm such a big fan of the show, you're hilarious. He was like, well, let me get on my Page jacket. And he, like, put on his Page jacket, and we took this picture, and it was just, like, this bizarre, crazy New York experience. It was amazing.
That's awesome.
I love that story. I tell it to everybody who listens. Well, Ben, thank you so much for sitting down
thank
with
you,
us.
Guys. It was a pleasure.
If everyone could subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher.
You should like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and Twitter.
And you've been listening to All That Glitters from the album Days and Nights by Sweet Soubrette. Email us at podcast@classactorhack.com and sign up for our mailing list on the website www.classactorhack.com.
Bye.
If anything, my mother will listen to it.